KTB. If you live in Northern California, you've likely seen that bumper sticker with the iconic outline of the lake we share with the Nevada border. Keep Tahoe Blue is the message, and it's a worthy goal. The lake's pristine waters are getting less clear by the year. We look at the science behind the clarity and more. It's Lake Tahoe, and it's definitely all new and all blue on Blue Dot. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom.
And I'm Nolan Ford.
And later on, we're going to be joined by our special environmental correspondent, Sarah Bohannon. What are your special Tahoe memories, Nolan? Do you have any?
I remember the first time I went out there, I actually spent some time in the lake and was impressed by the waves coming in. It almost felt like being at the beach.
For me, it was July 4th. I spent with my daughter, Tiana, and I think it was in 2001. We were at Sugar Pine Point State Park. We had the beach and these giant boulders of granite all to ourselves. And we had a little wind-up portable radio playing NPR. And it was Americana music. It might have been Garrison Keillor or American Roots, something like that. It was great music. And we were watching the fireworks across the lake. And it was just a gorgeous night. And it was just I fell in love with Lake Tahoe right at that moment.
Well, we have a great lineup of scientists to tell us all about the state of the lake.
Right. And first up, we're going to have Sarah Bohannon and her interview with Jeffrey Schlatto.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for being on Blue Dot.
It's great to be here.
I want to go ahead and jump right into the 2016 Tahoe State of the Lake report your team puts out. What is it and what were your biggest findings, especially concerning water clarity?
Well, what it is our annual compilation of pretty much all of the monitoring of the lake we do, which sounds like it's just adding one point to a bunch of various parameters, but it turns out to be more than that. It's whereas we don't really give a report card grading to the lake, we do look at the data afresh each year, and really give a commentary on what we think is happening or what the major changes in a particular year. So this year, with clarity, it was a little bit of a mystery in that it was a dry year. I should add that our report, our 2016 report, represents all the data from calendar year 2015. So when I say it was a dry year, I'm referring to the 2014-2015 winter. So the one before the last one. So that was a dry year, continuation of the drought, and under those years, we would normally expect clarity to improve because there's very little being washed into the lake by way of contaminants. And a little bit to our surprise, we found the clarity decreased by about 5 feet.
Do you know if that's from natural causes, human activity, or something else?
Well, our thoughts right now that it's largely on account of climate change. And we have a lot of evidence to suggest why that is the case, but it's primarily the fact that we had relatively little snow that year. Normally we may have between 30% and 40% snow in a typical year. This year, of all the precipitation we had, there was just 5% was snow. So the water that came into the lake was rain, a lot warmer than snow melt. And that very warm, buoyant water, much lighter than the cold water of the lake, came in and literally floated across the top of the lake and obscured the lake's clarity.
Is that called the snow-to-rain ratio, or what is the snow-to-rain ratio? Because I've heard that affects the water's clarity.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it is. It's, you know, we have a certain amount of total precipitation. 100 years ago, there was about 50% of it came as snow. Nowadays, what's more typical is like 30%, something like that, with lots of variability year to year. This last year, we had the lowest ever, a fraction of snow, and that was 5%.
UC Davis has been monitoring the lake, I believe, since 1968. What are the overall changes you're seeing from then until now?
It's actually, we started before that, but probably in the very late 1950s, but there were gaps early on. But since 1968, there's been an unbroken record of clarity and nutrients and many other aspects of the lake. The biggest things, you know, the thing that jumps out and the thing that Tahoe is really known for is its clarity, and over that period, it's the loss of clarity, and that was something that really alarmed people throughout the 60s and 70s and even till today, that we have this iconic, pristine lake, and in a matter of a few decades, it was being seen to change drastically.
Besides Lake Tahoe's famous clarity being aesthetically pleasing, why does it matter how clear the water is in Lake Tahoe? Is it really a health indicator of the lake?
It is. Well, it's a health indicator. It's also an ecosystem indicator of the overall well-being of the lake. It's in some ways, it integrates everything. It integrates particles and erosion products that are washed into the lake, the growth of algae, just dissolved materials that wash in from the forest. So it isn't the clarity isn't a measure of any one of those contributors to it, but it's an overall indicator of that change. And it is aesthetic. You're absolutely right, but it does have economic ramifications. So water is drawn from Lake Tahoe for consumption. Unlike most locations around the country, we have a filtration exemption, meaning water doesn't have to be filtered because it's already so clear. Filtration is one of the most expensive water treatment processes, so there's a savings there. The other economic ramification is tourism. I mean, if Lake Tahoe was to lose its clarity altogether, then there becomes little reason for people to come here. It's not so special, and certainly people are taking their vacations in Hawaii or Chico or somewhere else.
Water clarity can also be referred to as secchi depth. Where does that name come from, and how is water clarity measured?
Well, the secchi disc, as we use it at Lake Tahoe, is a 10-inch white disc that we lower from the side of our boat at two locations in the lake in the middle of the day, and we have somebody with 20/20 vision, not wearing polarized glasses or anything, looking at this disc and measuring the point at which it disappears. So this is it sounds like a really simplistic technique, but it's highly repeatable, and it's something that doesn't change with time as far as the technology goes. We measure clarity in many other ways, but every 5 years there's a new and better instrument, but each one is slightly different. So where it comes from is an interesting story. So Father Angelo Secchi was the founder of the Vatican Observatory. This was back in the 19th century. An overall smart guy, the inventor of radio astronomy, and he was thinking of a way that he could help his friend, who was an admiral in the papal fleet, stop their ships from running aground. And so he devised this big giant white ring that they would lower down to see how far down they could see, to make sure that they could see down below the bottom of their ship so that they would be able to see rocks or reefs or things like that.
For those of us who love Lake Tahoe and want to keep Lake Tahoe blue, is there anything we can do to help?
Well, there's a lot that people can do, and that's a big part of what we try to do is educate people in best practices. So one of the largest contributors to the loss of clarity are very fine particles, and these come from erosion and just sanding of the roads here during the winter. So essentially, we ask people to do two things, and that is to do as little as possible to contribute to these fine particles. And so that may mean at your own house, for example, you would have best management practices to stop any erosion coming off your property. If everybody did that, then really there would be very little coming into the lake. The other factor that is starting to become recognized as being extremely important now in the light of climate change is reducing the amount of nutrients coming into the lake. And again, people can sort of do things there. They can They can use less fertilizers in their gardens. They can even drive less. So, for example, one of the largest sources of nitrogen into the lake come from car exhausts. So if everybody drove 20% less, then that would be a lot less nitrogen coming into the lake.
Is there anything else you want people to know about this issue or your findings?
I want them to know that Lake Tahoe is still beautiful. It's still blue. It's still one of the clearest lakes in the world. What the challenge is to keep it that way and to return it to what it had been before.
Jeff Schlatto, thank you so much for joining me on Blue Dot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back, more on the complex science of monitoring the pristine waters of Lake Tahoe. This is Blue Dot on NSPR, and we are talking about the science of Lake Tahoe. Next, we're going to talk to Dale Cox. He's a scientist from the United States Geological Survey. Dale, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Briefly, what's the role of the USGS in monitoring the hydrology of Lake Tahoe?
Well, the USGS mission involves natural hazards, water resources, mapping, ecosystems, environmental health, energy and minerals, and climate change. But at Lake Tahoe, all those come into play. So we're monitoring and measuring things like digital elevation to better understand the physical characteristics and the changes going on at the lake. And also our work is used to map everything from shoreline changes to the physical composition of the bottom of the lake. The USGS also provides long-term monitoring of water, measuring the water, sediments, minerals, and chemicals that flow into the lake, and the composition of the lake itself, the hydrologic composition. So we're also measuring selected species of fish, animals, and the microbiota they consume. These are indicator species, or the canary in the coal mine, if you will. We also do special studies and examinations of, for example, the impacts of climate change and natural hazards at Lake Tahoe and around the nation. For instance, I'm responsible for creating and managing large disaster scenarios, like I did the shakeout earthquake scenario and arc storm, a storm analogous to that one that devastated the state of California in 1862. And so we wanted to know what would happen. We want to know what happens with these big ones before it happens. And while earthquakes are a threat at Lake Tahoe, the big one may come in the form of massive storms. So our Arc Storm at Tahoe project looked at the impact of large atmospheric rivers. Those impacts were in the Lake Tahoe Basin and then also downstream into Nevada.
In 1997, then President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore got involved in this ambitious program to coordinate the scientific management of the lake that the USGS is part of. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so if you can go back that far, the Lake Tahoe Presidential Forum began in 1997. It actually began a little bit before that, during a time when environmental concerns were large and they were being portrayed to be at odds with business, and many times they were, but that was far from being ubiquitous, especially at Lake Tahoe. At Lake Tahoe, the environment, particularly the beauty of the lake, was in decline, and this was a huge issue for business. We all love Lake Tahoe because it's pristine, so the Lake Tahoe Presidential Forum brought the attention of the president and the vice president of the United States to determine what were the problems and what were at stake and how we could address them. So I was one of those federal employees that was assigned to the lake to work with the community, businesses, homeowners, scientists, resource managers, et cetera, to define the problems and what we could do about it. And so we define those problems as water quality, forest ecosystem restoration, recreation and tourism, and then also transportation. There were problems with all of those. And so to address the issue, the forum brought funding through the Southern Nevada Public Lands Management Act. It's called SNPLMA. And that allowed the Bureau of Land Management to sell public lands around Las Vegas, and part of that revenue would go toward addressing these problems. So in addition to working with the community, by the way, I also lugged a case of water at Mount Talek on the vice president's hike. That was President Al Gore. It also included Senator Harry Reid, Governor of Nevada, EPA Administrator Carol Browner, and others. By the way, it was very interesting when we got up there. There was lots of Secret Service in the trees and stuff like that. so there were, the whole thing was to focus on the issues at Lake Tahoe and how they were also issues for business.
And has that now been an ongoing thing, presidential initiatives at Lake Tahoe?
Yes. So that the funding from SNPLMA had a lot of projects associated with it, and those projects have been going on for the last 20 years, and they've made major improvements.
Moving forward, what are some of the goals for the USGS in implementing the presidential initiatives?
Well, we'll continue on with our long-term monitoring, everything that I had stated for recently. After I finish the Hayward scenario, which is what I'm working on right now, it's a magnitude 7.0 earthquake scenario on the Hayward Fault in the San Francisco Bay Area, I'll start work with colleagues like Mike Dettinger of USGS and Maureen McCarthy, Desert Research Institute, and probably even Jeff Slatow and his group at UC Davis to focus on a climate extreme scenario for the U.S. Southwest, and that would include Lake Tahoe.
Before you go, I know one of the initiatives for 97 was to do bathymetry, which is basically the mapping of a deep body of water. Can you explain to us how you go about mapping the bottom of such a huge lake like Tahoe?
Well, yes. So the last bathymetric map of Lake Tahoe was done in 1923. And so to handle all of the or to support all of the science that was going to be done up there, we needed a better map of the bottom of Lake Tahoe. So to do that, we were used and brought in some of the technology that had been developed for our ocean research to map the bottom of the ocean, and particularly the latest generation of multi-beam bathymetric mapping. So we brought in Jim Gardner, who was a specialist in this at the USGS Coastal Marine Group, and then also people from the University of New Brunswick who do these sort of things. And it's basically like mowing a lawn. You mount a multi-beam system on the front of a boat, and then you go back and forth across the lake. The deeper the lake, the wider the swath, the more shallow, the more back and forth you have to do. So you can see, and it gets very shallow. We didn't even do that part of the lake. And this gives us not only the bathymetric data, like the depth in great detail, but also backscatter data, which can be used to better identify materials that make up the lake floor, such as rocks, sand, mud. And so this data can shed new light on the hidden histories in the water of Lake Tahoe.
What's the deepest part of the lake?
The deepest part of the lake is near the North Shore, and that is about 1,645 feet.
Wow.
When we were doing this, we invited then the Secretary of the Interior to ride along with us. That was Bruce Babbitt. And, of course, we had this press boat because the Secretary of the Interior was going to go out with us, and it was covered widely in the press.
There seems to be a recurring theme, the press and the Secret Service descending on Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, right.
What would the Cartwrights think?
I don't know. I certainly don't know what they would think, even looking at Lake Tahoe and compared to, I guess, back when it was first discovered. When was that?
The Ponderosa. That was the Comstock days when that show
took
place.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Dale Cox, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Dale Cox, senior scientist with the United States Geological Survey.
Next up, we're going to chat with Steve Sadro. He is a scientist in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis who studies Sierra and lakes. Steve, I'd like you to put Lake Tahoe into perspective for us. Compared to other lakes in the Sierra Nevada range, how is it similar and perhaps more importantly, how is it different?
Well, the most obvious way in which Tahoe is different from other Sierra lakes is its size. If you've ever looked at a map, you'll notice right away that it's massive. We measure lakes typically in two ways, both in terms of the surface area of the lake and then also in terms of the lake volume. And in both those measures, Tahoe is much bigger than any other lake in the Sierra. It has the largest surface area by far and the greatest depth, giving it the largest volume of any other Sierran lake. It's funny, I was thinking about this. To put it in perspective for you, I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations last night. There are over 12,000 high-elevation lakes and ponds in the Sierra. And if we were to total up all the surface area from those 12,000 more or less 12,000 lakes and ponds, it would still only be 35% of Lake Tahoe's surface area. And even more amazingly, if we think about the volume of those 12,000 lakes and ponds, when you total those things together, the sum is still less than 1% of Lake Tahoe's volume. So it's really this sort of creature all to itself in terms of the magnitude of the lake.
What are some of the lakes around the world that are analogous to Lake Tahoe? For example, how does it compare to Crater Lake in Oregon, which is not surrounded by a large population and development?
Well, Tahoe's unique in many respects in terms of the other Sierra lakes that are present throughout the range, but it isn't alone. I mean, Crater Lake is less than half a day or maybe a little bit more drive north, and it's similar to Tahoe in its depth, although it's a bit smaller in terms of surface area. The lakes have very different origins. Tahoe is, I think, develops from tectonic activity, whereas Crater Lake is a collapsed caldera, a volcano in the Cascade Range. But you point out a big difference, too, in terms of their development around the lakes. Crater Lake historically wasn't exposed to the same kind of mining and land use development pressures that Tahoe underwent. The Comstock mine in Nevada resulted in natural resource use around Tahoe that was, I think, larger than Crater Lake ever experienced. And Crater Lake's catchment is much steeper. Access to the lakeshore is much more challenging. I think some of those logistical constraints and then also the developmental pressures historically resulted in really divergent pathways for those two lakes. One became a national park, and the other has stayed largely in private property ownership.
What are your personal research interests, and how do they fit in with studying Tahoe?
Well, the types of things I'm interested in are related to sort of how the biological, physical, and chemical factors all interact within lakes to affect their ecosystem function. I like to think about lakes in a landscape context, sort of thinking about how does the terrestrial environment interact with the lake to affect the biogeochemical cycling of carbon and nutrients, and how do those interactions affect the ecology of the lake, the organisms that live in the lake. One of the things I'm really interested in understanding is how a lot of these remote alpine lakes are going to respond to changes in our climate that are happening right now. How are warming temperatures and changes in precipitation patterns going to affect the amount of material, for example, that washes into these lakes? And what is less snow, longer residence times for water, warmer lake temperatures? What do all these things mean for carbon cycling and nutrient cycling in lakes? And what are those effects going to mean for water transparency or other measures of water quality? And really, the Sierra is a great natural laboratory to answer these kinds of questions because We have really strong natural landscape gradients with elevation in the Sierra. And that provides a really nice framework to be able to ask questions and do comparative studies looking at how variation in landscape attributes affects the lakes, or vice versa. And for that reason, Tahoe is a really interesting lake because it sits on the extreme end of that. It's a very large lake, a very large volume, with a comparatively tiny catchment area. And so that puts it in this position, in this spectrum of lakes, of being very distinct, and is a nice system to be able to compare other lakes to for that reason.
What would you say is the most challenging thing about studying such a large body of water with so many factors affecting it?
Well, it is complex, and that makes it challenging disentangling what the effects we're looking at. You know, if we're trying to figure out whether it's climate change affecting something in the lake or whether it's a change related to nutrient inputs or sediment loading. But one of the biggest constraints for the type of research that I do that comes with working on Tahoe is, in comparison to working on small lakes, most of the other Sierran lakes are really remote. And these are lakes you have to backpack to get into. And so that affects the type of equipment that you're bringing in with you. And the whole scale of your research program shifts when you move to a lake like Tahoe, simply because of its size, right? So to do anything on Tahoe just involves, you know, a different set of logistics, larger motorized boats, different time frames for sampling. For example, when I go out and measure anything in a lake, one of the first things I do is we call it a depth profile, and we'll lower an instrument through the water column and measure temperature and dissolved oxygen and conductivity and a few other things. And you learn a lot about a lake just from making a handful of measurements like that. To do those measurements in a typical Sierran lake, you're looking at maybe an hour, you know, a half hour to an hour and a half time frame to make the measurements. Doing something like that on Tahoe is a half a day endeavor just at one location. And the lake is so large that you really need to sample multiple locations. So everything just scales up, and the time allotted to do any of your tasks, you know, sort of scale up accordingly.
Steve, thank you.
Sure.
That's Steve Sadro, a scientist from the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis.
Thanks so much to all our guests from UC Davis and the United States Geological Survey. Blue Dot is a production of NSPR. You can check out this and past programs at mynspr.org or via your favorite podcasting site. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Schlom. And as always, I'm reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot containing a very deep blue one. Let's keep it that way.